introducing him. So I present our first speaker, Dale Arthur.
Another terrible introduction. Now all you can do is elevate this.
Thank you, Lou. One year he brought my wife in to introduce me. That was fun having her here until she introduced me. That was great. Well, it's a great privilege and pleasure to be back here, and I can't believe it's been 16 years. I told my wife this week, I said, going to Rochester this week, and she said, already? You were just there. So that year went by pretty quick for her. And every time I come back home, she goes, you're back already? Well, okay. Chesterton, as we know, one of the most prolific writers of all time. His literary output is still being calculated, which is one of the great pleasures, one of the projects of the Chesterton Society, is we're still hunting down things that he wrote and still finding things that he wrote. And it's not unpublished material, it's published material. He wrote for just obscure little magazines and newspapers, and we're still finding that stuff. Within the last year, we've probably found 100 new essays. It's just astonishing. Yeah. And then the other thing we're doing in our research is we're finding reports of speeches that he gave. And that's new material too. He gave well over 1,000 speeches, and so to get a little newspaper account, you know, quoting him from his talk, sometimes the entire transcript of the speech, all new material. I don't know how he had as much time as he did to do all the writing he did, but all genres, as we know, poetry and politics, and philosophy and history and theology, and literary criticism. But he said that he would like nothing more than to just sit and write detective stories. With the one exception of he'd rather just sit and read detective stories. And it's a wonderful paradox about Chesterton, because this great lover of the faith and great defender of the faith and of the family and lover of life, liver of life, defender of life, plotted and planned over 50 murders. and he carried them all out, too. That's what's so amazing. Chester says, the great advantage of the literary murderer is that he can sit happily by his peaceful fireside, devising 15 or 20 ways of murdering his wife, make money from it, and yet retain his wife after all. Now, this idea of exploring all the different ways of murdering one's wife brings up the first of many important points that I'm going to make in my time allotted to me here the next 4 hours. Chesterton really is the inventor of the cozy mystery. He's the one who brought murder home, as it were, because home is where the most dramatic events of life take place. Chesterton says most of the great dramas and nearly all of the tragic, terribly butcherly and bloody dramas were domestic dramas. Oedipus, Hamlet, Macbeth, so on. That's because the domestic setting preserves the unity of the drama. It's performed within a definite framework of time and space, and above all, with a more or less definite cast of characters. And so if that works for just the drama, it especially works for the mystery or for the detective story, because the puzzle has to consist of a definite number of pieces. We have to know what all the pieces are in order to put them together. And if it's not a puzzle, then it becomes, Chesterton says, a blank bewilderment, a mere paralysis of the mind. And this is how Chesterton really was the first purveyor of the so-called locked room mystery. the baffling crime that's set in a confined space with a limited number of suspects, and the reader and the characters are all on the same plane, the same playing field, and the detective. We all have the same clues available to us. Because up until the time of Chesterton, there were basically two different kinds of detectives in fiction. There was Sherlock Holmes, and there were bad imitations of Sherlock Holmes. But they always involved the super sleuth, the one who just knew way too much. Like those dweebs on CSI, right? Oh yeah, this particular seaweed is found in only three different parts of the Atlantic Ocean. I knew that. Someone who can hear someone walking in the next room and figure out that one of his parents is from Lithuania. And say something here about the detection club. Oh yeah, Lou wanted me to say something about the detection club. Okay. This would be the place where I would say that is here. In 1930, a group of writers, and this is after, you know, after Chesterton had started to establish himself as a writer of detective fiction, and a collection of these writers were forming in London, they created a group called the Detection Club. And they met not regularly, but frequently at a London Soho restaurant. And they had their own locked room. They had a secret ceremony to join the Detection Club. It involved a crystal skull and some very nonsense oaths. But they also subscribed to a set of rules which they agreed not to break as writers of detective fiction. And it was Monsignor Ronald Knox who wrote most of those rules. And I can't say what all of them are, but I can tell you some of the highlights. You know, no identical twins, right? Interesting enough, no Chinamen. The idea being, you know, if you have some strange, exotic character who can do things that no one else can do, again, that's a breaking of the rule. No supernatural reasons that, you know, you can't, if it's not rules of this world, you know, that's unfair for the reader, right? And so they all agreed. The first group of members of the Detection Club included Agatha Christie, Monsignor Ronald Knox, Dorothy L. Sayers. Chesterton was elected the president of the at the beginning. He was the first president. And some other writers you haven't heard of, but one who you have heard of, who is not associated with detective fiction, but did write some detective stories, A.A. Milne, the creator of Winnie the Pooh, was an original member of the Detection Club. But the whole thing was rules of fair play. Put the reader on the same plane so that nothing's unfair, and this is what helps create the great pleasure of a great detective story. Because what Chesterton did to break away from the Sherlock Holmes stranglehold on detective fiction is to come up with the underdog detective, the one who seems really outmatched, and he came up with the perfect character in the priest, Father Brown. The one who, even when he's first introduced in every Father Brown story, and there was a priest there as well. It's never the grand entrance. Oh, here comes the detective to save the day. You know, Sherlock Holmes with his cape. No, there was also a priest there. And his first line is always, perhaps you could also look at it. And that set the tone in detection fiction, so that created the Miss Marples and the Columbos, you know, who seem completely overmatched, but who sees something that no one else sees. And of course, some of you know the story that the Father Brown character was inspired by a priest that Chesterton knew. His name was Father John O'Connor, really one of the most important figures in Chesterton's life, who really guided him through his whole conversion process and received him into the church too, and heard his first confession after knowing him for over 20 years. It's a great story of how he met Father O'Connor. Father O'Connor was already an admirer of Chesterton's writings. He had been reading him in his newspaper essays, and had a walk with him, and said, you know, one of your weaknesses, he told Chesterton, is that you always assume that the poor people are good, you know. They're just as capable of evil as anyone else, is what he was telling him. Because Chesterton obviously knew that the rich were evil. And he told him some really hair-raising stories of things that he had encountered, that the priest had encountered. And Chesterton said, you know, I knew that the church could tell me about what was good, but I didn't expect the church to tell me about what was evil. And then that night they met two Cambridge undergraduates who had a very good discussion about art, and Father O'Connor was very well versed in, for instance, it was Baroque art in this case. And when he left, when the priest left, the two students said, "Yeah, you know, he's pretty impressive. He knows a lot, but I could never live a life like that because he doesn't know anything about the real world." And Chesterton said he almost laughed in their faces because he said they knew about as much of about the real world as two babies in the same perambulator. He said, and that's what first gave him the idea of the priest who they assume doesn't know anything about the real world. And that's what started giving the idea. But I just, within the last week, one of our members found an essay published in 1964 in a obscure publication, the Irish Ecclesiastical Record. You're a subscriber to that, aren't you? You get the Irish Ecclesiastical Record. You get, John?
I have a copy.
Yeah. Okay. All right. But so this was written by a woman named Ethel Ann Bell, and she was writing a reminiscence of meeting Chesterton when he visited Father O'Connor's church and school in Heaton, England, in 1934, and it's her personal account of a talk Chesterton gave. So here's new Chesterton material that we just discovered this week. And she quotes Chesterton's talks when they asked him, is it true that Father Brown is based on Father O'Connor? You know, they're priest. He says, partly, he said. You see, Father Brown is only a very small part of my friend Father O'Connor, who is certainly no fool, and is extremely neat in his appearance, and has, in fact, expounded to me, who am not, very sensible rules for the packing of a bag, which somehow I've never been able to master. And then Father Brown is made to be an Englishman and as dull as a Suffolk dumpling, whereas Father O'Connor is not an O'Connor for nothing. But it all began with a box of matches. Chesterton was sitting in Father O'Connor's house, and they were talking about Shakespeare one evening, and he wanted to light his cigar, and he needed some matches. And Father O'Connor said, you'll find a box of matches on that shelf. And Father Chesterton said he was struck by the priest's knowledge of the position of so small an object in such a well-stocked room. It was this observance of a small thing that led him to write a crime story where a man murders another man with a box of matches. A possibility that still fills me with horror, said new stuff there. You were the first to hear it. See, if you come here 16 years, you're bound to learn something new. Father Knox, Monsignor Knox, claimed on his personal knowledge that Chesterton actually wrote the first Father Brown story, The Blue Cross, which we're going to hear today at the Reader's Theater. When he went to a publisher's office and said, "What's selling right now?" because he needed money. And they said detective fiction. So he sat right down and wrote the first Father Brown story, The Blue Cross, sitting there in the publisher's office. That's a minute. All right. He wrote 50, over 50 Father Brown stories, and they continue by far to be the most popular thing that he ever wrote. And there's a reason for that, and it has less to do with Chesterton than with the reading tastes of the public, which, of course, are reflected by Chesterton's own reading tastes. The public likes detective stories. Why is that? Well, the cynical answer is that it likes bad literature, but that's the wrong answer. Chesterton says the public does not like bad literature. The public likes a certain kind of literature and likes that kind of literature, even when it's bad, better than another kind of literature, even if it's good. And this is not unreasonable, for the line between the different types of literature is as real as the line between tears and laughter. To tell people that they can only get bad comedy when you have some really first-class tragedy is as irrational as to offer a man shivering over a weak, warm cup of coffee that you have some really superior ice. Most people prefer detective stories and sensational shockers to other kinds of literature because, he says, by preferring it, they prefer to have it good, but if they can't get it good, they'll take it even if it's bad. But their love for the Sherlock Holmes stories is an example that they'd like it good if they can get it. The man in the street may prefer bad ale to good cream de mint, but he also prefers good ale to bad ale. And that's also with the books he reads. And writers have a hard time understanding this. And so do critics. Chesterton points out that we know that there's a lot of writers out there who are convinced that they've written this great novel, but they despise the man in the street, and they're surprised that no one wants to read their book. And they're angry that no one wants to publish their book. And Chesterton, again, reflects the taste of the common man, common reader. He says, "I would rather have the man who devotes a short story to saying that he can solve the problem of a murder in Margate than a man who devotes a whole book to saying that he cannot solve the problem of things in general." The critics, of course, have been unkind to detective fiction, and the problem is they won't come out and say what their problem is and what their criticism is. It's the notion that if it's popular, it can't be good. And that the common man can't be trusted. And Chesterton says, "By a curious confusion, many modern critics have passed from the proposition that a masterpiece may be unpopular to the other proposition that unless it's unpopular, it cannot be a masterpiece." Chesterton's own greatness as a literary critic, which I think is some of his most astounding writing of all, is his literary criticism, is that he really does give voice to the common man. He doesn't tell the audience what it should feel, he tells the audience what it does feel. He puts our thoughts into words for us, and when we read it, that's exactly what I was thinking. And Chesterton has such a great way of telling us what our own thoughts are. Now, why is it that we like detective stories? How does he explain that? Well, first of all, detective fiction always offers us justice, and we all have this innate sense of justice. It starts when we're children, pointing out what's not fair to our parents, right? We know about justice right away. If Tommy has something that we don't have, we understand justice. And of course, the best sort of, the detective story has justice acted out. The best sort of detective story usually begins with an act of justice, namely a dead millionaire. For some reason, millionaires make the best corpses. it just works better than any other corpse. But if a millionaire is not available, some other corpse will have to do. But Chesterton says, if there isn't a fresh corpse by the end of the first chapter, there's almost no reason to keep reading. And he said, the whole problem with the modern intellectual novelist, he says, is that he'll squander his talents by creating a very interesting, subtle character who's a skeptic or a free lover. And then, just when he's ready to be murdered, the author does not murder him. And Chesterton says, this is just a terrible waste. He says, a novel without death in it is a novel without any life in it. But of course, the reason we enjoy the murder, as much as we enjoy a good murder, what we really enjoy, of course, is the murder being solved, which is what I hope you thought I was going to say. The detective is a moral figure, and he's also a poetic figure. He's the reason why we can't let murderers get away with murder. The moral order has to be preserved. But why does the moral order have to be preserved? In one of Chesterton's earliest published essays, A Defense of Detective Stories, he says that it's the constant tendency of the old Adam to rebel against civilization, to preach departure and rebellion. By dealing with the unsleeping sentinels who guard the outposts of society, the detective story reminds us that we have to live in an that we are living in an armed camp, and we're making war with a chaotic world, and that the criminals, the children of chaos, are nothing but the traitors within our gates. And when the detective in a police romance stands alone, fearless amid the knives and fists of a thieves' kitchen, it does certainly serve to make us remember that it is the agent of justice who is the original and poetic figure. The romance of the police force is thus the whole romance of man. Now, as for the criticism that he once heard from a real detective who said that mystery writers know very little about the business of detecting crimes, Chesterton responded, "It seems to me quite a complete retort to say that detectives know very little about the business of writing stories." But this is a very good time to say that I'm going to continue my talk in just a minute after this word from me as a commercial entity. We do have a book out there on the table, a detective crime fiction written by a former CIA agent, and it's very, very good. And I would recommend that you buy it today. It's called Get Louis Stiggs. It's by Larry Pavlicek, who sadly died right after the book was published, but he did get to see it published, and I don't think that his death was any way connected to the publishing of the book, but I would urge you all to get that book today. Get Louis Stiggs. We published it actually, and I told him, you have to make it as gritty and realistic as you can, but you can't use any bad language. And this was the greatest challenge he ever, could have faced. And so the way he gets around it is one of the great artistic devices in the book of how he gets around the swearing. You can hear it without hearing it, which is what's so nice. But while we're still on the commercial break, if you join or renew your membership in the Chesterton Society, we're going to be introducing this special on the internet in just a couple weeks, but you could take advantage of it today. We'll send you two free books, collections of essays from the Illustrated London News by Chesterton, hardcover, free, just for your membership. So it's such a good deal that if you leave without doing that, that would be a mystery that I could not solve. Yeah, and then I have two new books out there too. Lou mentioned this one, Night of the Holy Ghost, but also there's a great collection of conversion stories called My Name is Lazarus. People whose conversion was influenced by G.K. Chesterton. Now back to our regularly scheduled talk. Every good story is a moral story. Children love stories more than anyone, and they understand this because they demand it from a story. Chesterton says, children are innocent and love justice, whereas we who are guilty naturally prefer mercy. And so the good mystery is always a moral tale. By the end of his life, however, Chesterton saw that there was this increasing tendency, even in detective fiction, that reflected the morality of the modern world, or rather the lack of morality. Because he says, when there's no code of morals, anybody may murder anybody because anybody may marry anybody. Obviously, a character like Father Brown represents morality, represents the good, and in representing the moral order, Father Brown defends the faith, but he also defends reason. Father Brown, in one of the stories, says, this is the Red Moon of Maru, people will tell you that theories don't matter and that logic and philosophy aren't practical. Don't you believe them. Reason is from God, and when things are unreasonable, there is something the matter. In fact, you could even say that Father Brown makes reason one of the virtues, or he shows how reason is connected to the virtues. In the very last Father Brown story ever written, The Vampire of the Village, Father Brown says, people who lose all their charity generally lose all their logic. In addition to the moral aspect, there's another reason we like detective stories. We like surprises! Didn't expect that. All right. The detective story is unlike any other story, says Chesterton, in this, that the reader only feels happy if he feels like a fool. The essence of the mystery tale is that we're suddenly confronted with a truth that we've never suspected, and yet we see that it's true. That's why they're sensational, because the great sensation is surprise. And the best part of the best kind of surprise is to be shocked by something that we already know. The answer was there the whole time. We just didn't see it. It was sitting there right in front of us. The best example of this is the Father Brown story, The Invisible Man, which I'm not going to tell you anything about. Because Chesterton says, one of the greatest crimes is to reveal the end of a mystery story and take away a pleasure that cannot be given back. In fact, Chesterton says, the people who give away the ending of detective stories belong in the lowest level of hell, next to Judas and all the other traitors. So the device of surprising us with what we already know is not only the basis of detective fiction, it's really how Chesterton does all of his writing. His essays are actually constructed like detective stories. They have surprise endings that you didn't see coming, except he was setting you up the whole time. And when he gets to the concluding sentence, you go, oh, of course. Yeah, there it is. But the essential, says Chesterton, of a good detective story is that it's simple. In fact, it's almost the definition of a bad detective story that it's complicated. The ideal story does not depend on a mass of details that nobody could possibly know. It depends on one fact which anybody could easily guess, but nobody does. For the murder story has, for its high and holy purpose, the pious intention of making the reader feel like a fool. It is thus an encouragement to Christian humility, the most excellent leveler of the foolish and the wise. The reader, thus religiously enlightened, should leap from his chair with a yell, crying aloud that he is an accursed ass for not having seen something so obvious and so simple. It's almost an act of repentance, because it means admitting that we were wrong, right? And now the truth has been revealed to us. The act of revelation is important to the detective story. The true object, says Chesterton, of an intelligent detective story is not to baffle the reader, but to enlighten the reader, but to enlighten him in such a manner that each successive portion of the truth comes as a surprise. In thus, it is, as in much nobler types of mystery, the object of the true mystic, not merely to mystify, but to illuminate. The object is not darkness, but light in the form of lightning. There's two kinds of mystery. There is the mystery that is the puzzle to be solved, the temporary mystery. And then there's the mystery that is a marvel to be contemplated, the permanent mystery, the eternal mystery. And solving the puzzle, the temporary mystery, satisfies us, but it only satisfies us once. But the eternal mystery is endless, and yet in contemplating it, we are endlessly satisfied. The ultimate mystery, the mystery of life, the mystery of God, is not something that we can solve and then walk away from. It's an ongoing mystery that we keep walking farther into. We face it again at every turn. As Chesterton says, the mystery of life is the plainest part of it. Now, how do we combine the two mysteries, that temporary mystery with the permanent mystery? Chesterton actually does it. In fact, in one of the Father Brown stories, Father Brown says, we're on the wrong side of the tapestry. We don't see the complete picture. We see the backside of it. Something that doesn't mean anything to us means something somewhere else. So there's this connection between the two kinds of mysteries. There's the connection between faith and reason. So I think I've solved everything that the Catholics came here to hear. But now let's do something, a little something for the Protestants, or at least for the former Protestants. What are the biblical principles of the mystery story? There are four biblical principles to the good mystery story that Chesterton brings to us. Number one, the last shall be first and the first shall be last. When a banker is found stabbed and a notorious thief is found standing over him holding a bloody knife, you can be sure that he's not the one who's guilty of the murder. It won't be the thief. In fact, he's the most obvious suspect. No, the killer should be the last person we suspect. If the story is well managed, says Chesterton, we should have a real moment of disturbance when the minister of the banker's church is summoned before his bishop and charged with the crime. And another moment of pleasing emotion when the crime is pinned on the bishop himself. The last shall be first and the first shall be last. The judgment at the end of any sensational detective story is like the judgment at the end of the world. It's unexpected. And just as the author of the story reveals the spotless aristocrat as the instigator of some unthinkable misdeed, so the author of Christianity tells us that at the end, the bolt would fall with a brutal novelty, and he that exalted himself shall be abased. Number two, seek and ye shall find. Chesterton says that humanity hates the idea of anything being hidden. That is, hates the idea of anything being successfully hidden. Hide and seek is a popular pastime because it hits that age-old idea that we have to find the thing that is hidden. And it assumes the truth of the text, seek and ye shall find. And the pleasure is all in the poignant moment of passing from not knowing to knowing. And mystery stories are popular, but that's because the author of the mystery deals with what is hidden. We seek because there are clues leading us to the answer. We examine the evidence because it points to the solution. And it's exactly the same way with the mystery of God, who has given us an abundant number of clues. In fact, almost too many. The third biblical principle, and one that Chesterton excelled at more than any other writer of detective fiction, is love your enemies. Father Brown not only seeks till he finds, he tracks down sinners to forgive them. And that's the mission of the church, to hunt down sinners, to find them out, to make them confess their crimes in order to forgive them. Father Brown always solves the crime, but sometimes he lets the criminal go because he's more interested in saving his soul than in punishing him. And the Father Brown stories are probably unique in the genre in that his arch enemy ends up becoming his sidekick. I'm not going to tell you any more about that. I don't want to go to hell. But the whole point is that the purpose of loving our enemies is not to crush them, but to convert them, to get them to come to our side. That's why we love them. Not to defeat them, but to convert them. Because we care about the truth that brought us to this side, and we want them to join us. And then that brings us to the fourth and final biblical principle for the detective story, the most important one. The truth will set you free. Not only does the criminal need to confess his crime, but we need to be released from the mystery. We need to know the truth. And anything that keeps us separated from the truth is a work of evil. Father Brown says, the true God was made flesh and dwelt among us. And I say to you, wherever you find men ruled merely by mystery, it is the mystery of iniquity. If the devil tells you something is too fearful to look at, look at it. If he says something is too terrible to hear, hear it. If you think the truth unbearable, bear it. There's a joy in solving the puzzle, because there's a joy in the truth. Or as Chesterton says, there's a joy in the right realization of things. So why is our man such a great writer? Because he tells the truth. But he tells it beautifully. He tells it as a surprise. Indeed, as a revelation. It feels good to feel like a fool when we read it. He's especially great because he makes us so often feel like fools, which is exactly what we need. And I thank you again for 16 great years. God bless.